Good morning, everyone. Good morning. This is Thursday, the 10th of May, and we're in Johannesburg, and in Centurion, indeed. And welcome to the final morning of the 5th General Assembly of the International Council on English Braille. Special hello to the web streaming people. My name is Mary Schnackenberg, and I've got a collection of announcements. But first of all, I want to say a special thank you to everyone for last night. I think we've had a wonderful presidential dinner, and with great speakers. And especially thank you to Kathy and the staff and all the team. A number of the people in the room may not realise that last night I was given this incredible gift. And I have to tell you that, yes, the elephant is in the room. He's sitting up the front, so you can meet him this morning. He doesn't have a name yet. Maybe we'll call him Centurion. Now, some more announcements, please. As Judy would say, pay attention. Please settle your account at reception before you leave the hotel, please. Put last night's gift in your hold, in the luggage that goes in the hold. Last night's gift that came to each of us is a beautiful set of manicure set. And the security people will love taking it off us. So, because it's metal. So, if we please put that in our hold luggage, that would be great. Yes, if you owe money for DVDs, please see Kathy. People who are leaving today will receive their DVDs. There are many more loose cables on the tent floor, so please tread warily. There are open carafes of orange, or cordial rather, on your tables, so try and avoid adding those to the floor. Now, Jean is passing around a paper asking you to write down the name of any open source, that is free, software that's useful to the sector. Jean's going to add the names and web links to useful software to her guidelines for small production facilities. So if you know of anything, can you find Jean's piece of paper and write it down? Jean will put a message out about that next week on the listserv. That is the executive list. So we don't get it one way, our announcements. So I'll give you the word when you can come in later for the come in to have a look at the elephant, but I think we'd better do that after our first paper. Now, I'll just check to see if anyone's got any questions. All right, it's my pleasure to introduce the last of the papers, Selecting Keywords. I Am Able, the Individualized, Meaning-Centered Approach to Braille Literacy Education. And Dr. Diane Wormsley is here to take us through that. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Mary. Can you hear me okay?
A little closer.
I'll get a little bit closer, okay? Coming before resolutions is kind of like the calm before the storm, I think. So... this is a slightly different paper from some of the other more technical papers and deals with teaching methodology, working particularly with children who are cognitively impaired. But I might say that this approach is really, to me, a very common sense approach and one which could be used with newly blinded adults or teenagers who are a little bit reticent to be learning Braille, just simply because it draws them in since it's meaningful to them. And that's why the name, the Individualized Meaning-Centered Approach to Braille Literacy Education. And in this, I'm going to describe each component of the approach. These components, once you have worked through them, can be used simultaneously. It's not a step-by-step process. It's also an unscripted approach. So any materials that a teacher uses are really directions to the teacher as to how to help a child, not necessarily a curriculum to follow. And that's a difference between this and the more traditional approaches where you have reading materials, you have a curriculum to follow, you know what words you're going to be using. So this one is very unscripted, and actually because of that it can be difficult for teachers sometimes to implement. They feel as if they're a little bit unsure of what they should be doing. And it really is very child or client directed. What I'm presenting today is a very shortened version of the approach. The longer version was initially written in Braille Literacy, a functional approach. And at that time it was called a functional approach. Functional to me meant it works, not functional literacy. This has evolved over the years to this I Am Able approach, the individualized meaning-centered approach. And currently I'm in the process of developing a practice guide for teachers to help them implement the approach. So the first component of I Am Able is, surprisingly enough, called Getting Started. And this can happen at any time in a child's or an adult's life. Basically, it begins with the expectation that all students who are blind or visually impaired and have additional disabilities, or not, are able to learn to read if reading is taught to them in a way that allows them to see it as meaningful to them. The first component in the approach consists of ensuring that students have an environment which provides them access to Braille as a written medium. This is often referred to in the literature as creating a Braille-rich environment. Among other things, it consists of reading to children from books which contain Braille and print, affixing Braille labels or items or on items in the environment in places where children can find them. I think that's an important thing. It's not good to put them there and then not tell them where they are. And to be exposed to their literacy medium, creating stories about their lives and reading these stories to them. And again, that piece of this is the meaning piece of this, because sometimes the stories that are read to children who are cognitively impaired and who are blind don't have much meaning to them, and they don't get out of them what they could if the stories were about them. Modeling the use of Braille reading and writing and giving them a range and variety of experiences which will provide them with language and vocabulary from which they can draw when reading. One of my favorite expressions that I tell my teachers all the time is, for someone who is a reader, it's what you bring to the reading process determines what you take away. I'll let that sink in for a minute, but each of us brings different things to the books that we read, the things that we read, and that makes a difference in what we take away from what we read, what we hear also. As we've learned from a lot of things, a lot of comments about things that we've said in the past. It's especially important for children who have additional disabilities that we have high expectations for them to be able to become readers. If our expectations are too low, this will result in diminished exposure to Braille, to stories, etc. And these children in particular need more exposure, not less. Also, it's important for all blind children. When you compare the exposure to literacy medium of a sighted child in the environment, what's in the environment for them in print, as compared to a child who is blind, you realize that the amount of exposure to Braille is just minimal compared to the amount of exposure to print. So we have a big job to do in early literacy in helping our students understand the world of reading, the world of print. So this is something that continues. This does not end in preschool. Children who are visually impaired need much exposure to experiences and language for those experiences, and it should continue throughout their schooling due to the fact that blindness imposes severe limitations on learning, thus limiting the range and variety of experiences a child may have. So the next component that we talk about is selecting what are termed key vocabulary words. And as you know, when you have reading instruction, you have a set of vocabulary words that children learn to read. I learned with the words Dick, Jane, Spot, ball. Very exciting words. The crux of I Am Able and what makes it different from traditional approaches to teaching Braille is assuring that the words introduced to the student who is learning to read are meaningful to that student. This approach, for those of you who are New Zealanders, you will recognize this, is based upon Sylvia Ashton Warner's description of her organic key vocabulary, which she used with her Maori students in New Zealand. And I just want to quote from her, because she said it far better than I can, in finding key vocabulary words and trying to figure out what those words are. Sylvia Ashton Warner said, "No time is too long spent talking to a child to find out his key words, the key that unlocks himself, for in them is the secret of reading, the realization that words can have intense meaning. Words having no emotional significance to him, no instinctive meaning, could be an imposition, doing him more harm than not teaching him at all. They may teach him that words mean nothing and that reading is undesirable." So, discovering what words may appeal to students who are blind and have additional disabilities is not always easy, especially if the students speak English as a second language, or are not very verbal, or are autistic, or have other disabilities that prevent them from telling you what they are interested in. However, if they are unable to tell you what words they're interested in, you can observe them, consult with parents and others who work with a child, and the words will present themselves. Key vocabulary words may not be the words that are typically used to introduce reading. For example, some of the words that our students have selected for their reading words are words like beep beep, lockdown, bumpy ball, colonoscopy, tattoo. And these are not generally the first reading materials of most students. These very words, however, are among those which appeal to students with whom this approach has been used. Often, students who are severely cognitively impaired, even those who can speak, do not initially know what words they want to learn. When you ask them, they really can't tell you. But as you begin working with them, one of the things you realize is that they begin suggesting words that they want to learn, and they begin to own their own learning experience. So the next component is introducing the key vocabulary words. Once you've chosen them, you have to teach them. The selection of key vocabulary words needs to be fairly broad. And if it's easy to find a lot of words, the initial formal introduction of the reading vocabulary needs some manipulating. Students who are not yet readers need to be introduced first to words which are tactually distinct. This is really important. So when examining the key vocabulary words which have been discovered to be of interest to the student, it's important to try to select those which are most meaningful, and then also most distinct from each other. If the words are too close tactually, the student will not be able to learn the words as quickly. When introducing the words, teachers should create a word card that allows for smooth tracking. It is at this point that the teacher must teach the student how to move the fingers across the line of Braille smoothly. To discourage scrubbing, I Am Able includes a line before and after the word. Generally, the lead-in and lead-out lines are created by using a line of dots 2-5. A space is included before and after the word. The dots 2-5 permit discussion with the student about where to place this center line on the finger pads in readiness for the Braille word, which comes somewhere in the middle of the line. Because this may be the first introduction to teaching tracking to the student, the larger the card, the longer the line, the better. Tracking the word then becomes similar to tracking a line of Braille. I Am Able teachers promote a two-handed method of reading with both hands together and as many fingers touching the line of Braille as the student can accomplish initially, I should say. The child is taught to track across the line, identify where the word begins, continue tracking smoothly over the word until the space at the end, say the word, and then if necessary go back to the beginning and retrack the line. When words are first introduced, teachers generally do not talk about letters or sounds unless the student has a word that begins with a letter he or she already knows. Instead, teachers point out tactually distinct features of the word, such as length, the density of the dots at the beginning, middle, and end, particular letters which might be tactually distinct, such as an L. Teachers work to develop with the student what I call a, quote, language of touch, a mutually understandable, with which the student can describe other words. So one of the students' clumpy letter. Clumpy is a nice adjective for a G. There are other clumpy letters, too, which you might have to distinguish from G later on. But it gave us something that we could talk about together. Multiple opportunities are created to see the word cards and practice reading them. If the student has previously learned some letters which are in the word, the teacher can capitalize on this knowledge. Otherwise, as students begin to have more and more words to discriminate from each other, the teacher will help the student gradually learn the letters and sounds from the beginning letters and sounds of keywords and introduce phonics with other related activities. And there's a section on phonics and spelling skills. Essentially, to me, the initial introduction of words provides the same gross tactile discrimination skills of things like large, small, long, short, that many pre-Braille programs do. The difference is that these are learned and applied immediately to the Braille itself, rather than trying to teach students to discriminate sandpaper or textured blocks before exposing them to Braille. The next component is teaching students to track across multiple lines of Braille. Teachers also create tracking stories for keywords. This consists of creating lines of Braille containing lead-in lines and lead-out lines with the same word, creates a scenario around the word which gives meaning to the tracking activity. For example, the child who liked the word phrase bumpy ball had a tracking story where bumpy ball rolled away and the child had to search for the ball. The child is told the story scenario and that he is looking for the bumpy ball, and then the teacher helps him learn how to track the lines with both hands together, moving across the first line to the end and then tracking back to the beginning of that line and down to the next one. The child is to let the teacher know when he has found the bumpy ball by saying the word. These tracking stories help reinforce the look of the word and help the student learn how to move from one line to the next in Braille without skipping lines. Once at least two words are learned, the teachers can play games like Concentration or Monster Munch. I don't know, you probably know what Concentration is, but Monster Munch is a box that has a mouth, and you feed, the student reads the word card and feeds it into the monster, and then the monster either says yum, yum, yum if it's correct, or spits it out if it isn't. The kids really enjoy this game. It might not work as well with adults. Creating key vocabulary stories. Discussions with students about their likes and dislikes can lead to the collaborative creation of some simple repetitive stories. These stories can help introduce what we term filler words, words which make the key words into sentences. For example, a student who likes bumpy ball might help write a story like, I like the bumpy ball, Jim likes the bumpy ball likes me. Sound familiar? Similar to beginning reading things. But with the words that are meaningful to the student rather than Dick and Jane and Spock. Or you could write a story about all of the things the student likes. I like bumpy ball, I like cupcakes, I like a horse. Learning phonics increases the number of words a student can read and use in stories. Students can also learn to write words included in the newly learned word wall. Have I skipped a page? I did. Collecting the stories that the student writes into a booklet and imprinting above the words allows others to share in and help the students read the stories. As students learn to write using the Braille Writer or Slayton Stylus or Mountbatten Brailler, they can try to write their own stories. Another important component, a very important component, is teaching phonics and letter recognition and contractions. The word discrimination approach that we start with initially can only go on for so long. And as students begin to increase the number of words that they know, the discrimination has to go from gross tactual discrimination down to finer and finer discrimination. So you're really moving from gross to fine discrimination in this approach. And at some point, you have to teach the letters. You have to teach the contractions. You have to teach onset rhyme. which is like the beginning sound and the ending sound of a word. Teaching phonics, letter recognition, and contractions. Instead of using traditional phonics-based programs where all students learn the same letters and sounds in the same order, IAmable introduces phonics according to the initial consonants and vowels in the student's key vocabulary words. Gaskins discusses the four developmental phases of learning to read words. These phases are the pre-alphabetic, partial alphabetic, full alphabetic, and consolidated alphabetic phases. IAmable begins in the pre-alphabetic phase. Teachers point out the distinct tactual features of the words to students, which will help them remember the word and distinguish it from other words that are learned. Obviously, the more words students learn, the types of cues they are initially learning will no longer serve their needs, so they must move from gross differences into finer distinctions, such as the letters which begin the word or other key letters in the words. Moving into these finer distinctions moves the student into the partial alphabetic phase. This is when it is important to introduce letters and their sounds, particularly initial sounds, in order to help students begin to recognize letters and use them to recognize words. As the student learns more and more letters and uses them to help him recognize words, he is bound to encounter words that start with the same letter. These will then need other letters to continue to be recognizable. As letters are learned, so are contractions. IAmable uses contractions from the beginning of instruction. For phonics instruction, teachers capitalize on the onset rhyme patterns in the key vocabulary words to build reading vocabulary and the understanding of word patterns. A key vocabulary word such as ball from Bumpy Ball can provide a raft of all words, A-L-L, in which the student replaces the onset letter with another letter. Taught after the student has learned to recognize the letters B, C, W, the teacher and student can make the words ball, call, wall. Or the letters can be learned from making the words. A student whose family enjoys shopping at the mall will love making the word mall. These words can be included in stories and can be made into word cards for playing games and word recognition activities. Learning phonics increases the number of words a student can read and use in stories. Students can also learn to write words included in the newly learned word wall words, which helps them with their spelling. Teachers following IAmable use diagnostic teaching and take their cues from their students as to whether they are pushing them too quickly or not moving them quickly enough. They are constantly applying the students' reading and writing vocabulary to real-life situations and expanding the students' vocabulary. In addition, record keeping is a huge necessity. Because the approach is individualized and each student is learning different words in a different way, in order to keep track of what words the student has learned, a continuous list of words needs to be created. Students need to review all of the words they have learned periodically in order to determine whether they are still remembering them. Research on IAmable. This is not a component of the approach, although it should be. Because of the nature of IAmable and the population for which it was designed, it is difficult, if not impossible, to conduct any kind of large experimental research study. Until recently, anecdotal accounts coming from teachers who had used it successfully with their students were the only means of assessing the efficacy of the approach. In 2011, two teachers, Amy Campbell and Vicky DeRuzio, Amy is from the United States and Vicky is from Canada, provided case study data on the success of their students with whom they had used the IAmable. These are the first two documented instances of how the approach was implemented and its success. In July of 2011, the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction funded a research study to determine how successful the IAmable would be with non-reading students who are blind and have additional cognitive disabilities. For this study, a practice guide was developed, providing more detailed suggestions for teachers on how to implement the approach. To be eligible for the study, students had to be between the ages of 8 and 18 and not currently making progress in learning to read. 10 teachers whose students met the eligibility criteria were selected to participate. This study is currently underway. Results are preliminary, but each of the teachers in the study feels that her teacher is making progress. And I used the her because they were all women. The teachers have a range of experience teaching students with visual impairments from 1 to 30 years, the mode being 12 years of experience. Each received training in literary braille during their training at a university training program. And the students range in age from 8 to 14 and exhibit a range of disabilities in addition to blindness and cognitive impairment. These are shown below. And we had quite a range of additional disabilities. We had one who was identified as having traumatic brain injury, one traumatic brain injury with mild, or two, with mild physical involvement, two who were identified as autistic, one who had autistic tendencies was an English second language student with extreme attention issues. This student also happened to be the youngest student in the study. One with physical disabilities, one with speech language impairment, one with secondary learning disability, and one with communication delay. So as you can see, this is not a group of students who are like each other in any way, shape, or form. And so what we're looking for in the analysis of the data is patterns with these. Each teacher works with the student for at least two sessions per week and for at least a half an hour per lesson. However, some teachers have spent more time with their students than others. Each teacher is documenting her implementation of the approach using the record-keeping forms that were provided in the study. A daily lesson summary is prepared for each lesson. This includes which component or components of the approach are being worked on in that lesson, any modifications to the planned lesson and the reasons, and comments on the outcomes of the lesson. As each new word is introduced, it is documented, and practice dates are recorded. Mastery is considered achieved when the student is consistently able to recognize the word when shown that word along with other words learned. Each month, students are given all of the words that they've been introduced to and asked to identify them. Records are kept whether they are able to identify the words or not. Teachers are also keeping track of the activities they do with students and the games and the different approaches that they try that the students enjoy to share with others who might want to implement the approach. Teachers periodically take video of the lessons using a flip camera provided to them through the study. These are placed in a Dropbox folder shared with the principal investigator in order to document progress. Preliminary reports by teachers show that all students have learned at least one or two words and are tracking smoothly across the braille that they are reading. Some students are making considerable progress. Two are reading and writing their own stories. I should say three, because at the time of the writing, only one was, or two were doing this, now three are. One using the Mountbatten, the other two using the Perkins Brailler. The range of progress is large. At the end of the study, which will be mid-June when students leave school, the results will be included in an article to be submitted for publication. The practice guide will include revisions based upon the participation of the teachers and students and will be ready to be submitted for publication, hopefully, within the next year. I don't know how much time I have, Mary, but I did want to talk about two of the students, if possible. If not, I'll take questions.
Yes, you've got plenty of time.
Okay. The one student that I mentioned who was had autistic tendencies, he was English second language, and also had an extreme attention disorder, was the youngest student in the study. He was 8 years old. He is worked with he's in a special resource room for children with disabilities, not all visually impaired. And his itinerant teacher works with him every day. She comes in once a day for about 45 minutes. And the interesting thing about that 45 minutes is that when the study first started, he did not have a 45-minute attention span. He now has a much longer attention span. This little boy is reading. He has a reading vocabulary of about 100 words now. He had none at the beginning of the study. And he is really seriously reading primer material that is with the words that he's interested in, and tons and tons and tons of what we call filler words, but which are really just your basic Dolch word vocabulary list if you look at them, because they're the little words you need to make the stories, like and of and a and in and things like that. His teacher is not only thrilled with his progress, but she's thrilled with the reaction of other people to his potential. And I think this is one of the things that I really feel is important about this approach, is that it assumes right from the beginning that children have potential to learn, that they have stories to tell, that they have things to say. And it respects each child for what he or she has to offer. And the children reached up to meet this expectation. And I think that's a key part of this. One of the other students was a little girl who was in third grade, and she was 11 years old. Because she had cone rod dystrophy, her teachers had been trying to teach her Braille using a traditional approach, and she had not been making much progress. And I should say that in print, which she had been reading, she was only reading very haltingly at about the first grade level, but not with a whole lot of comprehension or success. And this young lady, during the course of the study, has now lost all her remaining vision to the point where Braille is her primary reading medium. And because of the approach, she took to it immediately and started just immediately telling her teacher all the words that she wanted to learn, to the point where the teacher was a little overwhelmed with all these words. But she has a smaller reading vocabulary than this little guy, the 8-year-old. She also seems to have more of a learning disability than people initially discovered. But she is reading probably, I think her reading vocabulary now is about 60 words, which, again, it was not at the beginning of the study. She really didn't have a very good reading vocabulary, nothing in Braille. So those are just two of them. I'll give you the other opposite end of the range. We have a student who is 12 years old. He is extremely autistic, very severely cognitively impaired, probably more than the moderately cognitively impaired that we had wanted for the study. And he has learned to discriminate four words. His teacher is thrilled. His mother is thrilled. He is thrilled. And it doesn't sound like much progress, but when you think that this is a student who really no one had any expectations for him to ever be a Braille reader, and he pays attention during the lesson, he doesn't exhibit behaviors that he might have exhibited previously, his attention span is increasing. Initially, his attention span was only about 10 minutes, and his teacher has managed to increase it to about a half an hour by varying the activities. So we see progress in each of these students. The progress is different, and I have a ton of variables to sort through when I analyze this. Because of the limited number of students, we really aren't going to be able to do much but a very broad pattern analysis. But I am noticing two things. One of them is that the amount of time spent in teaching reading is a huge variable here. The two students, and now I should say the three students who have made the most progress, are worked with every day. Every day. And this is something that we've said, but we really didn't have any way of looking at it. So I'm going to be interested to see how all of these patterns come out. The other thing is that this is not an easy thing for teachers to implement. You know, I find this kind of a fascinating thing. Teachers would much prefer a script to follow because then they know they're doing the right thing. I don't think it's so much that they need one, but the confidence in their abilities to determine what they should teach next and what should come next isn't always there. And so at the beginning of implementing this approach, the comfort level of the teachers is not very high. And they need some hand-holding and some reassurance that they're doing the right thing. And they need to be able to say to someone, I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think? And you say, oh, that would be wonderful. And then they're fine. They can go off and do it. But I had hoped initially that a practice guide could be available that would allow teachers to do this without any support, and I'm beginning to think that somehow that support has to be there also, and I have no idea how to provide it, but that's where I am right now. So I'll entertain any questions at this point.
Hands up. John's going to sort this microphone shortly. It's really feeding back.
They've all been reading their resolutions.
I think so.
Pete.
Pete
Osborne. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, Pete?
Just to say, I think this is an excellent approach. I guess part of my interest in some of this is that it isn't that long ago that people felt very uncomfortable talking about, you know, blindness and visual impairment. And, you know, we had organisations in the UK that still had the word asylum in their title and various things like that. I still think we're very uncomfortable. Sometimes the language is very uncomfortable when you start talking about people with complex needs or, you know, whatever. So, you know, and I think this whole area where increasingly, you know, children who may have a visual impairment also have other disabilities as well, it's globally not as well understood as I think it might be. And I wonder if you might comment on particularly how some of the language is developing, how people are referred to, and whether you think there could be any sort of research or guidance given, particularly to organisations, certainly like RNIB, which I think are struggling with this. They organisations know they need to do more for people that have got a whole range of we call it complex needs, which I'm really not altogether comfortable with. But, you know, I think we're struggling to know how to deal with that and how to refer to people in a way that's not, derogatory or offensive.
Oh, you don't give me any easy questions, do you? Or hard questions? It's interesting. When I think of children who have additional disabilities, and I guess that's what we use in the States, additional disabilities, it's so hard to give them terms. I think you almost have to give them a larger term because they're so different from each other. You very rarely find two kids that are identical in their abilities and needs and background of experiences. And just like with the whole population of people who are blind or visually impaired, it so much depends on early upbringing and just a quantity of factors. So, Pete, I have no idea what to tell you. I'm sorry. I mean, I just think you kind of have to call it what it is. And just, I think the important thing is respect. These are individuals. I don't care how severely cognitively impaired or severely impaired they are. They have something in them, and it's our job to find out what that is. And this approach helps do that much better than any other approach.
Sarah from Nigeria.
Thank you. I'm just trying to, I'm wondering, there are some children that do not concentrate when you're teaching them. Sometimes it's not because they have any disabilities, just that they don't feel interested at that time.
There are adults who do that too. You know?
Oh yeah. the interest I have is in the fact that in Nigeria at least, I know that the cane is usually used on such children. Maybe the teacher would hit the child's finger, maybe the reading finger or something, when the child is placing it wrongly. I'm wondering, is it right? Then is there a way? At what point do you determine which child is just being distracted and which one has a disability?
Well, you know, what you try to do when you teach is to motivate students, and there are good ways to motivate them, and there are ways that aren't quite as beneficial. And I know that in the past, we used punitive reinforcement for learning. I it's not an approach that I would favor. I think that if a child is being motivated in this way, it's not a collaborative learning experience. And I think it also says that there's not as much respect on the part of the teacher for the student as there really needs to be. The teacher needs to see the child is capable of learning and then figure out how to let the child know that the child is capable of learning. And it's not easy. It really isn't easy. And some of the children we work with have behavior difficulties. So what you need to do is think of that behavior as communication and to figure out why the difficulties are there. And this is the whole area of multiple disabilities. And behavior management with children who have behavior disabilities is a big piece of this. One of the difficulties that we have, and Pete, what's your name? this might help address it, is that many of our teachers don't have background in working with kids with behavior disabilities or with children who have mild physical impairments or cognitive impairments. They've learned how to work with children who are blind. And so these other aspects of the child need to be addressed as well. And Sarah, I don't know if that's answering your question, but I guess I would, you know, to give you a straight answer is I wouldn't tolerate it.
Good question, Sarah. Thank you.
Betty?
Canada's fighting over the microphone.
Oh. Betty, did you want to say something or do you want me to?
No, you go ahead.
Okay, it's Jen. I just, and I've talked to Diane a little bit about this, I won't say too much because we're online, but I'm tutoring a student, and I'm not a certified teacher. I, to be honest, didn't know what I was getting myself into when I said yes to this. But reading this and hearing you talk, I would love it if the student's teachers were aware of this, and I'm just wondering, how are you sort of getting this out there to teachers so that they, you know, they have an opportunity to try this with their students if they're so inclined? Because I think that the student I'm tutoring could benefit from something. So
in the past, I've done workshops. American Foundation for the Blind, after the Braille Literacy, a Functional Approach was written with Frances Mary's nagging and telling me that what I had was a stream of consciousness and needed to be organized in some better fashion. But we did workshops. We did a number of them. And I continue to do workshops. The practice guide will hopefully be published and available to teachers within, I even hate to say how much time, a year maybe. So that will be out there for people. There are articles in JVIB and will continue to be articles in there. So that's how I'm trying right now. I'll tell you, I had approached the Institute for Education Sciences in the United States to do a research study three times, three proposals, and was turned down each time. And usually there was a comment about statistical analysis, or is this really a good approach? We don't have any evidence. And, you know, it's hard to convince funding entities that you have something that can work when you don't have anything other than anecdotal evidence on it, which is one of the reasons I was trying to get the research. So it's kind of a catch-22.
Jean?
I think it's my turn, Mary. It's Betty. Diane, I'm very interested in this, and in fact, you know, have taught some adults and somehow managed to do this without knowing about any of the research or understanding that this would be helpful. Certainly just taking a functional approach and using words that will motivate the student. But I'm wondering, have you looked at this with, you know, it would be wonderful to do kind of an ongoing study with students who are not using this method and students who are using this method to sort of track progress and to really indicate how good or not this kind of program would be. I mean, it's obvious that it's good. And I really hope that you get funding to do more because I think it's very exciting. And I think whatever level of literacy anyone can attain is wonderful. And I very much appreciate the work that many of these teachers are doing with children whom, you know, some people might think about as kids, well, you know, why are they bothering? And, you know, it's so important for kids and to know that they are learning and getting excited about reading words, and eventually words will have meaning for them in their homes, and it just enriches their lives, and I think it's wonderful what you're doing with this research.
Thank you, Betty. I just want to make one comment. I mentioned in the paper that because of the nature of the population, it's really difficult to do any kind of experimental research design. And when you start talking about comparing students who, some who are learning with the approach and some who are not, there are so many variables to take into account that it's really difficult. So what we've used with this approach instead is a single subject research design where you collect baseline data on student progress prior to the implementation of the approach, and then you take data as a student progresses through. So you're really using the subject as his own or her own control. And the only way you can demonstrate efficacy or the fact that it works with a single subject research design is to have enough people doing this and making success. And so, you know, we have 10 students now in North Carolina that we'll be looking at, and hopefully we can encourage people to do more of the same kind of research to demonstrate this. But the other piece of it is research on how, what teachers need in order to be able to implement the approach. And there is a lot of need on the part of teachers. So I think I'm kind of coming at it from both ends. And I'm going to retire, I'll tell you, before any amount of research has been done that shows that it works. It doesn't stop me from doing it.
Fred, did you call? Did you make a call?
Yes.
All right, Fred, you're next.
Thank you. Really a comment and then a very quick question. I first got into the special education field in the 1970s, and one of the things that we were taught then is that the population of blind children had changed, and the attitude, not to be overly harsh about it, but basically was there were a lot of multi-disabled children who just simply couldn't learn, and so you just wrote them off. Nobody said it quite that bluntly. And for all these years since, I keep hearing the population of kids with multiple disabilities is increasing and therefore throwing our hands up and what can we do? And so my comment really is to say this approach really, I don't know how to say it other than just it encourages me so much, irrespective of whether it turns out to be dramatically better or some better or moderately better, the idea of shifting the focus to say it's not the child's fault that he or she is not learning. We're the educators, and it is our responsibility to try to match our strategies, our approaches, to facilitate learning among all children. And I just want to say I have such great admiration for what you're doing. My simple question is, the tracking line, when you were talking about dots 2-5, I always wonder, and I don't know that there's anybody's ever looked at it or even if it matters, but I wonder if a row of X's would be a better tracking line in that the pad of the finger is, in effect, in a trough. But if you know anything about that, I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Fred, we actually use that with students who have difficulty with the middle line. But the reason for just the single line initially, if we can do it with that line, when kids start reading Braille initially, their fingers numb out so quickly because they haven't had any tactual exposure for the most part. And so the more dots you're feeling, the more dots you're tracking, the more quickly your fingers will begin to numb out. And so to prevent that, you know, the single line is good, and in the middle is good because that's how you can position your finger relative to the rest of the Braille. But there have been kids that we watch them and we see their fingers are missing either the tops or the bottoms of the letters. So we'll take an X, and that's a great way. Yeah, their fingers, their pads do go right in that trough and go across the line. So see, you're a great teacher, Fred.
Mike Townsend. Mike, did you ask for the call?
Yeah,
and you will be the last person.
Oh, good. Right. Diane, it's great paper, and I think it's excellent following on from the question that came yesterday. And I'm very interested that we should share the concept and the idea across in the UK. So we'll follow up on that one. However, in the UK, we've done some research on people with learning disabilities, and it shows that a far greater number than was ever expected have a visual disability. And actually that's impacting all across the spectrum. And so I think we need a greater understanding, and that's what they're doing work on at the moment, to find out how much their visual disability is impacting the understanding of their learning disability. Everyone's an individual, and it's a very hard group to, as you said, Diane, to get a real understanding and a sort of cohort or a group that you could analyse, because they are so individual. But we must do it. And I've got a story. I want to tell you a story. I tell children stories, actually. And
quickly, Mike, please.
I won't tell you the actual children's, but the story's a good one. A little 8-year-old boy used to come and join in and listen to my stories that I told to all the other kids. But he didn't react at all. He had a visual disability. He couldn't move very well. He couldn't speak. But he just was there. And from 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, Daniel used to be in the summer holidays with my stories that I told them. At the age of 13, a method was found for Daniel to communicate. And you know, it all just poured out. He actually poured out the stories I told him as an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old. They were all in there. So what I want to confirm what you were saying is our respect for the individual. They're all individuals. We've got no idea what's inside there. And I think the second... So I've got two. The words go together. Respect and expect. Expect something to happen. If you put input to them, you can expect things to happen. So it's respect and expect.
Thank you, Mike. Right. Thank you very much, Diane, for your stimulating paper this morning.